Welcome to my podcast, and my guest today is an extraordinary author, Tim Marshall. I hope I've read quite a few of his books, and I thought I'm here sitting with him to concentrate on the power of geography and to look forward to his latest book, The Future of Geography. So I'm really honoured to be sitting in the morning room with Tim.
Wild dogs could not have prevented me from getting in here, Lady C. This is
the
nice. It's just great. It's just such a great experience to come to Highclere. So thank you.
Well, you are kind, and funny, in many ways, Highclere is where it is because of geography, because yes. of the chalk water, the downland, the light soils to the south of here. There's Bronze Age, Neolithic, Iron Age remains. So geography is often my starting point, and it's what my husband studied at university at Oxford, whilst I was more ancient languages and German, funnily enough. But here today, I'd love to chat to you about the power of geography, mm-hmm. which I simply adore. And I know that I wouldn't dream of asking how many copies you've sold of The Power of Geography, but I know The Prisoners of Geography sold 2 million, which is an extraordinary figure, and I imagine The Power of Geography is going towards it and heading onwards with the next book, The Future of Geography.
I have to say, Prisoners of Geography, that is over an 8-year period in several different countries, but it is still
staggering.
And I'm more staggered than anybody else, and probably happier than anybody else. It was a phenomenon, and it was mostly word of mouth. I was not a known author. I was a little bit known as being a foreign correspondent on television in this country, but hardly a known author, and it was just word of mouth. And I'm pretty sure it's because it approaches, as does power, international relations and countries' politics through the foundation of the geography of that country, because that partially explains all the things that happened. What reminded me to say all that is your description of, people built this on this particular spot for a number of reasons, all of them to do with geography. Yeah.
It is actually, and I really like understanding why we're living here and why we continue to live here. And I think it also helps us all understand the tensions in other parts of the world and why they exist. And yes, they may be man-made, but partly also as a result of the geography.
Yeah.
And my sister Sarah gave me The Prisoners of Geography. I think friends have given it. My husband gave it to me. I've given it to him, and so on. So I hope we've contributed towards your 2 million figures, and also by word of mouth.
I'm thinking
you're
of retiring
quite right.
because of that.
No,
thank
please
you.
Please do. But I love your style of writing. It's very digestible. The matter you're talking about is incredibly important. And I'm somebody who, in your last book, flipped between the chapters, actually on the basis of my own research and reading. And I began with Saudi Arabia. And then I think I went to Australia, something completely different. Mm. But that's really nice, because you're very reader-friendly in allowing people to do that. I know that I've gathered from yourself that you write it with 10 chapters in an order.
Yeah, it's linear, and it's a structure which I find helps me get things down not simplified fashion, but yeah, it's a structure.
Well, it's coherent and formed.
Yes.
And geography is about formation, so.
Yeah, I know where I'm going. I mean, for example, sorry to jump ahead, but in The Future of Geography, this book about international relations and space, I deliberately put China as a chapter and what they're doing in space ahead of America, because I think they're much more unknown. And then that leads to America, the two great space rivals. But it's only then that I say, at the very end of the America chapter, did I mention Russia? Something like that, which, leads you on to Russia. So I've always got in my head, once I've got the structure, I've got the structure before I've written a word. You know, I want to have this chapter, this chapter, this chapter, in that order, this is what I want to say. And only when I've got that structure do I then start writing.
As an author.
Yeah, you are, yes.
I am writing in such a different way. I have a jigsaw puzzle and I'm writing about someone I don't really know much about.
But it works for you, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it kind of works for me. So I end up working in...
So you put the pieces in as you go along where you think they fit.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I completely respect that. I just... You know, it's just different ways of arriving at the same thing.
I find it fascinating how we all try and write and how I try and write, you're definitely writing, and how you're trying to form the journey, the ups and downs, trials and tribulations, the tears, the love, the laughter, the tragedy of anybody's life, which also is again, part of the geography where they live and therefore who they live with. And obviously, I think we mentioned here that all the bedrooms at Highclere are named for the old Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
Such as Mercia, Wessex?
Mercia, Wessex, Northumbria, East Anglia. We've got Surrey.
I stayed in a hotel in Stratford recently. This is a true story. And I stayed in the Macbeth room.
Crikey.
But I tweeted the next day, I was kept up all night by some bloke clanking around in chains. Hope you don't get that here.
No, I really hope you don't. But the fourth Earl of Carnarvon was a very keen Anglo-Saxon historian.
Yeah.
So, and he was always reverting to the history of Wessex. We're not far from where King Alfred the Great, you know, was at Winchester. The main entrance here was towards Winchester, geography again.
Yes.
It lay towards Winchester, and yet the big hill here, Beacon Hill, the old name was Weald Settle from Anglo-Saxon times. And obviously we point straight towards Southampton and the Romans who came in here. And again, because of the geography, they came straight up past here.
Yeah.
They knocked down the Iron Age fort on the top, one of the tribes.
Well, I was thinking about the hilltops.
Yeah.
The reason some of our towns have grown up where they are is that in Saxon times and Wessex and all the rest of it, you better build on the top of that hill and a big fort, because if you build it lower down, they're going to come and get you, which is exactly why they did. And also all those names you just came up with, like Southampton, Tun being 100, I believe. Ham was when it was a very small hamlet, and it would have been South Ham. And I mean... Do you know where Highclere, what Clare means?
I think it's just, it's all about the view. There's King's Clear, it's a clearing.
Right.
And there's Burghclere, Bur meaning town in Anglo-Saxon Burg.
Right.
And King Clear was held by the king, and Highclere was granted by King Cuthred of Wessex to the bishops of Winchester.
So Clare means?
Clearing, clear. It's,
yeah, a clearing in the forest.
View. It's a view, yes.
Right.
And then equally well, I spent yesterday with some Norwegian friends because you've got wit, bi, grins, bi, and that word means town, which is Viking and Norwegian.
And that's why, because it was the Vikings, they came down the east coast, and that's why along that coast you so many places BY. Should we just junk talking about my books and just talk about, you know, the Dane law?
Yes. Well, I also think that, you know, obviously the chapter, I read it last of the Power of
Chapter on Britain.
The chapter on Britain. I wanted to go round the world before I came back, because I think England at the moment is such an extraordinary, slightly fragile position, given we've left our nearest neighbours. And we've gone back to the seas that lie around us. And I wanted to understand your take and your discussion on that. And I found, again, that actually reassuring, going back to where we came from, although I'm also obviously quite worried about it, because I think neighbours are better as friends, just from a normal point of view. But I found that fascinating.
I mean, I don't want to particularly venture a view that for or against Brexit, because... It just annoys people. So I would just say that I do think that the fact of being an island had a psychological effect on the vote. I mean, you can't measure that. You there's no polling that can be done, you know, deep down in your subconscious. And, you know, you can't ask people that, because we don't know. But there is a collective psyche in a community or in a nation. And we do know our history. We do know that that strip of water did protect us from Napoleon, did protect us from Hitler, the Spanish Armada. And to an extent, I think you can argue, protected us from some of the extremes of politics. The ideas found it harder to come across as well. And I think that collective memory of the island race will have had some sort of effect. There's also the fact that an island nation also has a pretty well-defined sense of itself. I mean, we are four nations within one, but a pretty fine defined sense of itself, like, for example, Japan does. And I think there's quite a lot of similarities between Japan and the UK. So it has shaped us. And then there's the undeniable things. We have a very jagged coastline, and jagged coastlines equal deep water ports. Deep water ports means you can have big ships. Big ships means you can get out there into the proper oceans. We have long, flat rivers, excellent for internal trade, which allows you to build up an economy. We have oak trees, pretty good when you want to build a navy. You know, if you've got bamboo, not so good. So there's a whole bunch of geographic reasons which go alongside other things which explain why we are what we are.
Does, I think it reinforces tribal aspirations.
Yes, no, I don't think that's a stretch. I think we are all tribes. I mean, it's another word for a community, if you like. You know, we were...
Well, I was thinking of that when you were writing about the earlier tribes in this country coming together under England. And was it King Edward the Peaceful, I think you identified, which was very nice. I love anyone who's going to be peaceful. And then coming together then to seek that coherence of community. And again, you're just bringing it back to geography, which I find so interesting. And in many ways, the geography here, many people who work here don't live far from here. You know, it's quite an interesting community again. And one of our keepers, Eddie, we asked him when we were doing a march to support the countryside whether he'd come with us. He's never been to London.
Oh, that's not unusual.
And it's not unusual, but we're not that far from London.
But people don't... I don't want to say something that makes it sound as if I'm being aggressive.
No.
But that many people in the national media have come to London to make their fortunes.
Yes.
And they mistake themselves and London for the country. Mm. And it doesn't cross their mind that... Many, many people have never been to London or have been...
And actually don't wish to go.
Yeah, or have gone and thought, yeah, that was all right, and then that's it. And still to this day, the majority of people live, I forget the actual statistics, but it's something like, it's definitely a majority, they live within about 60 to 70 miles of where they were born. Yeah. That is the overwhelming majority of people in this country. And it's actually true of people all over the world. And yet we have this idea... of the modern globalized world, which is slightly at odds with the experiences of most people.
Which I think for me is also the appeal of Jane Austen, you know, because she was writing about her local world and the characters are universal figures.
Yeah.
And the stories from here are the same universal. And there was a gardener called Bill Sticker and he'd never been to London. So he and his wife decided to catch a train to go to London. And they dressed up in their best clothes and went to Newbury from Paddington. When they got to Paddington, feeling very, very nervous, they saw this sign: Bill Stickers will be prosecuted.
Yes.
So, of course, do you know what? They got back on the next train and came back again.
His parents clearly had a sense of humour.
That was it. But it's extraordinary. And it's nothing against them, thoroughly sensible. It's so interesting how we're all... And yet we're then crowded together and trying to find a way to grow our food and live in peace. And again, geography is the foundation for farming and food, which has really never been so held to the fire as today.
I think... Many people have had a wake-up call over the past few years with two major events, one being COVID, and seeing how supply chains can grind to a halt, including partially food.
Yes.
But
Brexit was a big contributing factor to that.
But now with the Ukraine-Russia war, the breadbasket of Europe, and indeed for huge parts of the world with the grain prices shot up enormously and there was a huge shortage. And it has a knock-on effect in places like Sudan and Egypt, where grain is subsidised, but they're having to buy it at higher prices from elsewhere.
Yes.
Prices go up. And when you put up bread prices, as you'll know from your reading of history, people get cross.
Mm.
And I think this has been another wake-up call about supply chains, but also about the food supply. I mean, last week from recording this podcast, the Russians who've already bombed the ports in Odessa, including the grain warehouses, They actually bombed a town on the Danube River on the Romanian-Ukrainian border and destroyed some more grain because they were trying to get it out by river instead of by sea. And grain prices shot up 8% overnight. This is still a partially globalized world. This has been, I hope, a real wake-up call about food supply chains, because, of course, climate change will also have an effect on these as well.
Well, we're a farm. My farming records here, I found them going back to the 14th or 15th century. And we're trying to grow food well, but we need to grow it. We're on that balance, that middle bit of ground between the better land and the not such good land. Mm. The fields are surrounded by wildflower meadows and goodness knows what, all encouraged by the EU and the stewardship levels, none of which have been embraced by the current government, which makes our life very challenging. And yet we can't just farm the landscape for beetle banks. We need to farm to grow the wheat, the barley, the oats, which we need to eat. You can't necessarily reduce and remove all farming from this country. We need to do that. Mm. So we are at the close point of that. And again, our geology is quite important. We have actually managed to plant a vineyard in the old walled garden.
I was just coming to that. I didn't know you had, but the plus side is the English wine is getting better.
But we still need to have wheat and barley and oats, and with our weather this year, I'm not
sure
what we'll get.
Did you see there was an English Pinot Grigio which won the World Pinot Grigio Blind Tasting Test and beat an Italian one into second place, and it's from Gloucestershire, I believe.
Extraordinary. Yeah. Well, that's very happy.
That's climate change.
And that is great. And equally well, we still need to grow the other crops because we all do still need to eat bread. And it is challenging. And there's a balance and a coherence, which is so often missing from the politicians, which is there within the communities and on the ground. So I think sometimes your books as well, to my mind, point out the realities of geography and the short-termism of politics, mm-hmm. because geography is by its nature very long-term. And we're quite long-term here. So there's perhaps a real affinity for Jordi, my husband, and I, and you, when you're writing our books and we're reading them. Because we are always thinking for the long-term. We're here for a bit, pass it on, see what we can do. And that's what your books put out as well. So I think they are an important message.
Thanks. You've reminded me of a line that's in the new book about space called The Future of Geography. Musk says that he's going to have 1 million people on Mars in 2050, which is pure fantasy. But the other fella, Bezos, has got, as well as his spacecraft business, he is actually already, his team, designing space cities with agriculture. But here's the point about you reminded me of it. He is, unlike Musk's fantasy of 2050, he knows we will not have space cities for 200, maybe 300 years. You know, it's that far out that the technology required to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people living in a massive, massive sphere, which is going round and round at a Lagrange point, because there is a geography to space, L5, is the best place for it. But it's about 300 years away. The point being, despite knowing he will never live to see it, he wants to start the process so that people can build on that. And what reminded me, because you reminded me of that phrase, you don't plant a tree to sit under its shade. You plant a tree for your grandchildren to sit in the shade. You know, I think it's a very positive attitude to take through life.
So, Tim, I know that your role as an author, life as an author, has succeeded a very successful career as a foreign correspondent. But was that something you always wished to enter into, that of a foreign correspondent?
Yeah, since I was a kid. I had a romantic view of it because, you know, conflict is exciting, but it's not romantic. But when I was a kid, I'd heard the BBC recordings of the D-Day landings. I was very interested in the Vietnam War, and I fancied, you know, that sounds like an interesting job. But I mean, I left school at 16. I had no qualifications. I went off on the building sites, so I never for a second thought I would become a foreign correspondent. But through various machinations, in my early 20s, I got a break and I got in and took it on and went on to, you know, to Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Kosovo and Bosnia.
Who was your main employer at the time, can I ask you?
I started at LBC Radio, a short while at the BBC, then back to LBC to go to Paris for 3 years. And then when I came back from Paris, I joined Sky News. And so I think the real, real formative years would have been from about 1992 and then in the Bosnia in the mid-90s and then on, as I said, onto places like Kosovo and Afghanistan. So, yeah, I never dreamt I would be a foreign correspondent.
But did you always think there was a book in you?
Well, you know, that saying about everyone thinks there's a book in them.
Yeah.
In my early 20s, I kind of fancied the idea of being an author, which is a very different thing. You know, some people want to be an author
work,
as opposed to
it?
Wanting to write. You know, you've got to want to write.
Yeah.
And then when I quit full-time journalism 8 years ago, I honestly did not know how I was going to make a living. Mm. I was burnt out, I'll be honest with you, and that was because of the pressure of working for 24-hour news, but also alongside that, mostly doing conflicts. So I didn't know what I was going to do. I had already written a book a few years before about Kosovo, didn't sell particularly well. I then wrote a book about British football chants, which is actually all really about Britain, about how we talk to each other on the terraces and our cliches, and where do those cliches come from. Mm. You know, it's a bit of a history of Britain in some ways. And then I hit upon this idea of using some of my experiences and my reporting and knowledge of various countries to explain those countries, but through the prism of geography, because I'd learned early on in Bosnia how important it was to understand the terrain. Mm. Because when you understood that, where that river was, where it goes to, where that motorway leads to, why that valley is important, then the decisions that military and political people are making become a lot clearer. So I took that template and then put it into written form. Mm. And, you know, it seemed to hit a chord because it gives context to complex events. So, you know, I have no regrets about that previous career, but I've also got no regrets of stopping that and doing something else, which is writing. Yeah.
So if you were a foreign correspondent now, you might well have been posted out to Ukraine. I think all of us wonder how it's going to play out and how long it's going to take to play out. Do you have any views on that, Tim?
I would have been there, and I'm not sorry that I'm not getting on in years, but also, you know, I just I'd had enough of that sort of thing. I follow it closely. I write about it in columns, and I remember writing last summer that they're going to go through a whole winter of this, and then they're really going to go at it hammer and tongs this summer, and if they are both mutually exhausted and hurting, by the autumn, you might see the glimmers of talks. I think that's still the case. The current counteroffensive is going slowly, but some people have written it off too soon. It's only this week that the Ukrainians have actually put into the fray this extra heavy armour that they got. You know, we have spent the winter sending the Leopard tanks, the Bradley fighting vehicles to them. And just this week, for the first time, they've committed dozens, possibly as many as 100, to the front lines. They have broken through, although this isn't the Battle of the Bulge breaking through. This is a couple of kilometres advances in very small areas, because it still can go either way. So that's at the moment. Russia can't win. It just has to make sure it doesn't lose. And Putin will do whatever it takes and will have as many Russians dying as it takes. So there is this scenario. If this counteroffensive does not properly break through, possibly even getting all the way to the Sea of Azov, which would cut the Russian forces in two and cut the land bridge that connects the Russian forces on one side down to Crimea. If they can't do that, what happens in the autumn is we're back to this attrition. And at that point, in various capital cities around the world, the voices that are already saying this in private start to say it publicly. For how much longer are we going to pay you all this money and send you all this weaponry and all these missiles, because our own stocks are being depleted?
Mm.
For how much longer, when we did that and you still didn't break through? So tell me how this ends. And I think that in the event that this offensive does not work, really work, I think we will hear that surface in the autumn, and there will be a test at that point of Western resolve. If we pass it, then I'm afraid we are locked in for another year. If we don't pass it and we pressure them to go to the table, I'm not sure they'll have much choice but to go to the table and compromise, which will be a bitter, bitter pill for them to have to swallow. Last bit, sorry, I mean, I could talk about this forever. The last bit. Putin is working to a different clock. Putin is working on holding on until Trump gets back in.
Yes.
In 15 months, at which point, if he does, he knows that a majority of Republicans in Congress already say the Americans are giving too much support to Ukraine. And if that's the case, the pressure will be massive on the Ukrainians to come to the table. Putin is waiting for that, because he thinks he'll be in a stronger position. So those are my only three scenarios.
Mm.
Forced to the table because the assault doesn't work, or we're in this for the long haul because it is our fight as well, or get to next November and the rug is pulled from underneath them.
I think they have found an extraordinary leader in Zelensky, who is very understanding, and he has an extraordinary wife. So the two of them are giving their country the greatest chance of trying to resolve their borders and bring the country back.
Cometh the hour, cometh the man, and in this case, the woman as
really
well.
Has.
But Biden said last year, nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. It's not true. Behind the Ukrainians' backs, if they choose, the Americans, the Germans, the French, if they choose to, will engineer it that you have to come to the table now, because without their help, Ukraine cannot get any further. So, you know, it isn't. You have to say publicly in diplomacy, of course, this is your choice. Of course, Ukraine makes its own decisions.
Oh,
they're
politicians.
The reality is,
there's many parties involved.
Yes.
In the decision about whether to stop and to start, so completely and utterly. And I've had some very interesting discussions recently, and it is realpolitik.
Yes, it always is. Now, look, they have been incredible, the Ukrainians, and there's all sorts of machinations that you can do a deal with where they're given guarantees. They can give up, it's not for me to say, but theoretically they can give up the Donbass, or they get parts of the Donbass back. Crimea remains. They recognise that it's been, you know, there's all details that can be thrown in, but at the moment the plan is break through, get to the sea, be in a massive position of strength, and force the Russians to the ones that make the concessions.
Yes, I mean, you don't. It is absolutely fascinating, and then you've got the Wagner Group, and you're back to your book. In the Sahel.
The Wagner Group, honestly, they run the gold mines in some of the countries in the Sahel, Niger, Chad, Sudan, Mali. And this is why it's a nonsense that the Wagner Group's being disbanded. They need, you can put a give them a different name if you want, but they're not getting disbanded because the gold that they get their big share of is they smuggle it out to the UAE. You just fly it out. From the UAE, it goes on to Moscow, and Moscow needs that gold to pay for its war effort. So the Wagner Group's not really going anywhere.
No, I suspect, Abby, it must be fascinating to hear some of the conversations behind closed doors.
Gangsters. You're talking about a gangster state dealing with gangsters. And when Prigozhin was publicly slapped the other day, but not very hard at all, for marching on Moscow and shooting down Russian planes, all he gets is go away. This is one gangster saying to another gangster, hey, what are you going to do about it? I'll give you a deal. You know, we're not dealing with great statesmen and women here.
Thank you very, very much for coming today. Thank you.
Thank you.